Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is O'Brien et al. Appellants versus Western South Dakota Technical Institute and the Rapid City Area School District Appellees. For the appellants would be Veronica Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellees would be Mr. Thomas Harmon and Ms. Carla Engel, attorneys from Pier. My understanding is, Ms. Engel, you will speak for 10 minutes, and then Mr. Harmon will speak for 10 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very well. Ms. Duffy, you may proceed.
Please the court and counsel. I am here representing the appellants in this case, who are teachers and former teachers at Western Dakota Technical Institute. They asserted three claims in their complaint against Western Dakota and the Rapid City School District. The first is a claim sounding under the Equal Pay Act, which is codified at 29 U.S.C. Section 206D and is part of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Their second claim was an appeal of a decision of a school board pursuant to South Dakota Codified Law Chapter 13-46. And their third claim was a claim under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
You just said it was an appeal from a school board. So we've had some difficulty in the briefs. Who is the entity that you are suing? I mean, are you seeking claims against both?
We are seeking claims against both, yes.
All three claims against both entities?
No, the appeal of the school board decision goes solely against the school board.
And then are the other two claims solely against Western, or not against the school board?
The other two claims are asserted against both Rapid City School District and Western Dakota Technical Institute. There was an issue raised below before the trial court, which the trial court decided not to resolve, and that is the legal status of Western Dakota. At the time that we filed the complaint, and to my client's best knowledge, Western Dakota is a separate legal entity and was their employer, albeit it had some oversight exercised by the Rapid City School Board. We now know, on the basis of Mr. Harmon's filings, that there's some issue about whether or not Western Dakota is a legal entity, but that issue has not been resolved by the trial court.
Can we resolve it, or do we have to remand?
I believe, based on the procedural posture of the case, it has to be remanded, Your Honor. That's because this case comes to you on the basis of a 12B5 motion to dismiss.
Well, clearly you want it remanded for a trial, but I'm talking more narrowly about that one issue of who is the proper party defendants here.
Your Honor, there are two separate issues with regard to who is the proper party. One is, as a legal matter, are they a separate legal entity and can they be sued? Secondly, is there some claim that we can make of ostensible legal entity, for lack of a better terminology? Western Dakota has their own stationery, which does not mention Rapid City School District anywhere. They have issued each of my clients an employee handbook, which is in their own name, Western Dakota, and it does not mention that they are employees of the school district. The statute or the session law that Mr. Harmon cited to us, I think, has some ambiguity in it. So that's an issue on which we would, and we did request before Judge Anderson, additional discovery. So that we can determine what's the legal status of Western Dakota. We would have no qualms about dismissing Western Dakota if it turns out at a later point that they are not, either factually or legally, a separate legal entity.
And then you'd simply pursue the school, Rapid City School District?
Correct.
All right.
Under the Equal Pay Act, our claims, our arguments are pretty simple. Neither legislatively nor as a matter of judicial gloss through the case law have we found any support for the requirement of administrative exhaustion that was argued by the defendants in this case and upon which our Equal Pay Act claim was dismissed. Every case that I have been able to find indicates that there is no administrative exhaustion requirement for Equal Pay Act claims. And though I have searched and searched, I have not found any authority to the contrary. I believe that if this court were to hold that South Dakota, unique among the 50 states, is at liberty to impose their own procedural administrative exhaustion requirements on the Equal Pay Act, that that would violate the Supremacy Clause to the United States Constitution.
Well, maybe it's throwing you a little bit of a softball, but wouldn't we have potentially 50 different exhaustion requirements for the 50 states if there is some kind of non-supremacy argument prevailing here?
Exactly, Your Honor. And where that's legislatively required, such as under Title VII, Title VII specifically requires right in the statute that you must exhaust administrative remedies either before the EEOC or before your own state human rights division. And typically there are some differences in the exhaustion procedures in the different states, but at least the claimant knows from the outset that they have to go through either the EEOC or their state division of human rights and exhaust administrative remedies before they file in court. And under the Equal Pay Act, there is no statutory requirement for doing that. And none of the cases have interpreted the Equal Pay Act to require that. So in this case, I suppose it could rise to the level of a due process violation were South Dakota to hold at this point that we alone are going to require this administrative exhaustion requirement. But it's clear that none of the state and federal cases that have addressed this issue have held so. The reason why I believe that imposing an administrative exhaustion requirement on Equal Pay Act claims in South Dakota would substantially burden the federal right that's guaranteed under the Equal Pay Act is because of how the statute of limitation works in Equal Pay Act cases. Under the Equal Pay Act, you get back pay for 2 years from the date that you file your complaint in court. Now, under Title VII, your back pay is measured from the date you file your administrative charge. If we were required to administratively exhaust under the Equal Pay Act here in South Dakota, however long it took us to exhaust before the State Division of Human Rights, that portion of time would be subtracted from our statute of limitations and therefore subtracted from our measure of back pay. Now, sometimes cases go through the Division of Human Rights relatively quickly at a period of 6 months or 8 months. Sometimes they take 15 to 18 months to move through the Division of Human Rights and get a final decision. Those cases would impose an undue burden on the federal remedy that's provided by the Equal Pay Act. The appellees argued in their brief that this court could simply hold that equitable tolling applied to that period of time during which the Equal Pay Act claim was before the South Dakota Division of Human Rights. But again, federal law is unanimous on this subject. There is no equitable tolling if you unnecessarily exhaust administrative remedies for an Equal Pay Act claim because such administrative exhaustion is not required. On a collateral issue, I wish to point out to the court, and I've brought copies of the opinion for each of your law clerks, after the briefing was completed in this case on May 1st, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision, Nevada Department of Human Resources versus Hibbs. The decision date is May 27th of 2003. The appellees argued at page 11 of their brief that there was no special reason to suspect that South Dakota had not protected the rights of women in the workplace, and therefore no reason to suspect that our administrative exhaustion scheme was imposed as some kind of an attempt to thwart the rights of women in the workplace. Nevada versus Hibbs concerns the issue of whether or not the Family Medical Leave Act can be applied to states. As the court is no doubt aware, there's been a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in the last 5 years concerning various anti-discrimination laws and whether or not they can be applied to states. In holding that the Family Medical Leave Act could be applied to states and was not in violation of the 11th Amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court chronicles the history of constitutional violations in the gender discrimination area on the part of states. And they note that even though Title VII was enacted in 1964, As of 1993, when the Family Medical Leave Act was being considered, the stereotyped beliefs about the allocation of duties and family duties within the workplace had not been abated. And I will give a copy of this to each of your law clerks to read. And if you so desire, I will file a supplemental pleading after oral argument in this case. It's a somewhat collateral issue, and so I did not file a supplemental pleading beforehand. Nevertheless, the history of gender discrimination that's chronicled in the Hibbs decision shows that this is an area where the federal government has an interest in stepping in and making sure that women in the workplace are treated equally. And I'm glad to appear before this court. This is the first time I've appeared since Justice Meyer Henry was appointed to the bench. But I would suggest that because it took South Dakota 114 years to get their first woman on the Supreme Court of our state, we are neither better than nor worse than our sister states, the history of which is chronicled in the Hibbs decision.
Have you supplied a copy of that to your opponent?
I have, Your Honor.
Okay.
We would ask this court to reverse and remand on the dismissal of the Equal Pay Act and hold that administrative exhaustion is not required for that claim. Our second claim is an appeal of the school board decision, and as Justice Zinter pointed out, that is solely against the Rapid City School District. The primary issue under the dismissal of this claim is whether or not service by mail is appropriate for the notice of appeal in this case. And I will readily concede there is an open question of law on that issue. There was a decision rendered by this court in 1992, Maggio, I don't know if that's how I pronounce it, versus McLaughlin School District, in which the parties argued about which method of personal service of process was appropriate under the statute that's at issue in this case, SDCL section 13-46-3. And the court in that case held that personal service of process was required. Then there was a later decision issued in 2002, Vitek versus Bonhomme County, which interpreted SDCL 7-8-29, which concerned service of a notice of appeal on a county board of commissioners for an appeal. The language of both statutes, 13-46-3, and 7-8-29 is very similar and simply speaks of service of a notice of appeal on the appropriate party. In the Vitek case, the service had been accomplished by mail, and the county argued that based on Maggio, the service should have been personal service of process. And this court held that nothing in the statute required personal service of process, and the court would not impose such a requirement if it was not specified in the statute. The court distinguished the Maggio decision by stating that in that case, both parties had assumed, without arguing to the contrary, that some form of personal service of process was necessary. Thus, I think after Vitek, the Maggio decision is somewhat unclear, and we would ask the court to explicitly overrule Maggio and hold that service by mail is appropriate under 13-46-3.
So what you're saying is there's no way we can uphold both cases. One's got to go.
It doesn't appear to me, Your Honor, that you can. There is some very minor difference in wording in the statute, but not as to the language as to service of the notice of appeal. And I think if one statute says service of a notice of appeal and that language is interpreted to mean service by mail is appropriate, then similar statutes with almost identical language should be given similar treatment.
Thank you.
The second issue under the appeal of the school board decision is whether or not exhaustion before the Department of Labor was required before my clients were entitled to file this claim in court. And in reliance on that, the appellees have cited SDCL Chapter 3-18, which requires public employees to exhaust, quote, grievances before the Department of Labor. Grievance is a defined term under Chapter 3-18, and it is defined as an argument by the employee that their employer has breached an agreement, a contract, an ordinance, a policy, or a rule of either state or local government. My clients are not arguing that their employer breached an agreement, contract, ordinance, policy, rule of state or local government. They are arguing that the contract itself, which the employer has honored, is itself a violation of federal law, not state or local law. Therefore, their claim does not fall within the definition of grievance under SDCL 3-18-1.1, and exhaustion should not be required for that claim. Furthermore, there's nothing in Chapter 13-46 which gives rise to this appeal, which would require exhaustion. And my final argument as to why exhaustion should not be required before the Department of Labor is based on our estoppel argument, which is outlined in the brief. And that is based on two separate statements made by the defendants to my clients. One, a verbal one, saying there is no formal grievance policy. All you have to do is follow the chain of command, which they did. And the second argument of estoppel is based on the actual letter from Mr. Hengen, saying that you have now come to the end of your exhaustion requirements with us and you're free to file your claim.
One of the exceptions to the exhaustion requirement is where the department does not have the statutory authority to grant the relief requested. Does the department here have authority to set aside or modify a contract of this nature where it may violate federal law?
Your Honor, I have to confess I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I have never practiced before the Department of Labor, and I'm not sure what the scope of their jurisdiction or authority is. The final claim that the appellants asserted in their complaint, and which was dismissed by the trial court, as I said earlier, is an equal protection claim under the United States Constitution. The defendants filed two separate motions to dismiss below. One was addressed to the Equal Pay Act claim. The other motion to dismiss was addressed to the notice of appeal of the school board decision. Neither one of those motions addressed the constitutional claim asserted by the appellants. Because there was no motion pending that addressed the constitutional claim, we made no argument below as to why that claim should not be dismissed. Obviously, it was not on the table. Nevertheless, the dismissal order dismissed the entirety of the complaint, which included the constitutional claim.
How did you bring that to, or did you bring that to the attention of the trial court, even after the fact, for reconsideration or an objection or something?
I did not. The answer to your question is I did not bring that to the trial court's attention. We received the order of dismissal. I have never practiced before Judge Anderson before, and I wasn't sure how well received a motion for reconsideration might be, and so I thought we were probably on the hook for an appeal because of the notice of appeal issue on the school board, and thought that we would resolve everything at once.
So you're saying this just kind of came out of the blue?
Yes. There was no argument made at the oral argument before the trial court that there was anything deficient about our equal protection claim, and I was not aware that that was going to be part of the dismissal. So in closing, I would just request on behalf of the appellants that the court also reverse and remand with regard to the notice of appeal claim and the equal protection claim, and allow these parties to go forward and conduct discovery and have a trial and have their day in court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Duffy. Ms. Engel, you have 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm here on behalf of the Rapid City School District and its program, the Western Dakota Technical Institute. I'd just like to, right off the bat, address an issue that you brought up, Justice Gilbertson, which was, under the Equal Pay Act, if we allowed administrative exhaustion, wouldn't we be faced with a series of variances between the states as to what their administrative exhaustion requirements are? And that's a legitimate concern. But I believe there are analogies to that, and the court has considered those and concluded that certain variances among the states are allowable within federal law. And a prime example of that is the statute of limitations. In Section 1983 claims, the court has determined, the U.S. Supreme Court, that it will allow variations in statute of limitations between states. And the reason it did that is because it concluded that it's unlikely that states would discriminate against litigants in that area. And I would argue to the court that the same is true here. It's very important to understand the kind of claim that the plaintiffs are bringing here. They are bringing an Equal Pay Act claim. They are asserting that they are entitled to equal pay for equal work. Now, they bring that claim under the Equal Pay Act, but they most certainly could bring the identical claim under Title VII, which is a broader federal law and prohibits any kind of discrimination in compensation on the basis of gender and employment. And so they could certainly have pursued this claim under Title VII. They chose not to, but most definitely plaintiffs have conceded that they would have to exhaust administrative remedies had they chosen to bring their claim under Title VII.
Well, now, I understand the Equal Pay Act was passed in the early 1960s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Human Relations Act of South Dakota comes in the early 1970s. Did Congress ever go back and amend the Equal Pay Act to require exhaustion? Because clearly, when the federal act was originally passed, there was nothing to exhaust in South Dakota. The Human Rights Act didn't even exist.
Right.
So how do we now graft in an exhaustion requirement that wasn't there when the original federal law was passed?
The way we do that is because this case is very different than many of the cases that Ms. Duffy has cited to you. This case is peculiar because it's a case brought in state court. And many of the cases that Ms. Duffy has cited to you concern litigants in federal court. Well, there is a fundamental rule that states have the right to regulate procedure in their own forums.
So you're suggesting if they'd brought this in federal court in Rapid City, there would be no exhaustion requirement?
Yes, Your Honor, because the federal court would not be required to apply the state statute that's in effect here, which is SDCL 2013-29, which says that any discrimination claim must bring before the Department of Human Rights, and you have to exhaust your administrative remedies in order to bring that claim. And so the argument that Ms. Duffy is making is that there's some concern that states have consistently discriminated in the area of gender, and therefore we shouldn't impose an administrative exhaustion requirement. But the fact is that had this claim been brought under Title VII, the claim could have been reviewed by the Department of Human Rights, would have had to have been reviewed, plaintiffs have conceded. And so where is the concern that the state would somehow treat this claim differently? I don't believe there's any valid concern in that regard, because the same claim brought under Title VII would have had to have exhausted administrative remedies. Now, what's the purpose of that? The purpose is to allow an agency that has expertise in this area to review the case. This agency would have reviewed it had it been brought under Title VII.
But does this agency have the authority to grant the relief requested here? I raised this question to Ms. Engel earlier, where you don't have a breach of a contract, you arguably have an illegal contract. At least that's what I hear her saying.
I would argue most certainly the department does. They do it every day. They review discrimination claims every day, and they make determinations of whether there's probable cause that discrimination has occurred. And then they proceed on to conciliation to try to resolve the disagreement short of proceeding to circuit court. And so they do that every day. Most certainly they have the authority to provide the remedy that the plaintiffs seek here.
Doesn't the complainant, though, in an administrative hearing also have the, at that point, at that stage of the conciliation, have the choice of going to circuit court?
Yes, they do. But our court has said they first have to meet that procedural requirement. In fact, they can file the charge, and within, I believe, it's 20 days after filing the charge, they can notify the department that they don't intend to go forward before the department, and they can proceed directly to circuit court. But this court has concluded that in other discrimination cases, most notably harassment cases, that you first have to meet that procedural requirement before you can avail yourself of the state forum. And that's the argument that we're making here, is when you choose state court, you should be required to comply with this procedural requirement. Now, Ms. Duffy makes
about the statutory, the limitations, the 2-year problem that you might run into if the administrative agency takes too long to investigate a claim.
In other discrimination cases, in the age discrimination realm and also in race discrimination, courts have applied equitable tolling where a litigant has been affected by something of that nature. The court can come in and say, we are going to equitably toll the statute so that you can go forward and pursue your claim. And the same would apply here. This court has the authority to equitably toll the time that's spent before the Department of Human Rights so that the litigants are not prejudiced by having to bring the claim administratively in the first instance.
But equitable tolling is a discretionary, it's a discretionary function. The court could deny it. Isn't that kind of a risky thing to do, to hope that you're going to get that toll, and then the court may say, no, I think you should have proceeded to court directly?
Well, if the court here rules that administrative exhaustion is required, I believe equitable tolling would be appropriate, and my clients would not oppose that. Another issue that Ms. Duffy brought up in her discussion was that there may be a due process violation in if administrative exhaustion is required. This is a new argument that was not previously briefed, but also I don't see how a due process claim would sound here, since we have, again, the same requirements for Title VII litigants. And they have to go through those same administrative hoops.
But, you know, you've said that a couple, three times now. This is not a Title VII case.
Right, it's not. But the importance of that, Your Honor, is that administrative exhaustion is required in Title VII. And where the court has said that there's federal preemption, it's because there's a risk that the state requirements are not really designed to further the purpose of the federal litigation, but in fact designed to foil it. And that's not the case here, because clearly if exhaustion was going to prevent states from cleaning up gender discrimination, then there would be no exhaustion requirement in Title VII. And so that's the relevance of the existence of administrative exhaustion in Title VII, is it's indicative of the fact that exhaustion would not hamper the purpose of the Equal Pay Act.
Well, there's also a fundamental difference in the statutory language between the Equal Pay Act and Title VII as well, isn't there?
You mean in terms of whether there's an explicit requirement?
Of exhaustion.
I would agree, except that because the litigants chose state forum, then they should have known that state procedural requirements would apply.
If they chose equal pay, they didn't choose Title VII.
Yes, you're right, Your Honor. But the importance of the fact that Title VII requires administrative exhaustion is that there is not a fear that the state is somehow going to hamper the litigant's claims. There's not some concern that there is a discriminatory animus. In the case of Felder versus Casey, where the court concluded there was federal preemption, in that circumstance, the state was attempting to apply a notice of claim statute that would cut off claims against state actors under Section 1983. Well, Section 1983 is designed to create liability against state actors. And so the court concluded that the purpose of the notice of claim statute was contrary to the federal legislation. That's not the case here. The purpose of the exhaustion requirement is not to foil the federal legislation. And the proof of that is we allow exhaustion on Title VII claims, which can be identical. And with that, I will yield the floor to my counterpart, Tom Harmon. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Engel. Mr. Harmon, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Tom Harmon, Cleveland Law Office, here representing today the Rapid City School District, which in fact brings up one of the very initial points that was being addressed to Ms. Duff, who is the actual party here. I would note for the court that our appearance is for the Rapid City School District. No appearance was made for the Western Dakota Technical Institute. As it is not an entity, and as this is quite clear from the session law that created it. And in fact, down at trial, Your Honor, There was a default judgment.
Mr. Harmon, I'm looking at the front page of your brief, and it says, "Appellees are Western Dakota Technical Institute and Rapid City Area School District," and it lists Thomas Harmon and Carla Engel as attorneys for dependent appellees. You prepared that cover sheet.
Dependent appellees, that's indicating that there's a single entity here, and it does have a program within it, the Western Dakota Technical Institute. No question about that, Your Honor. And below, in the trial court, there was a motion for default, no answer having been served on behalf of Western Dakota. That motion was withdrawn. The point to be made here, that this is a program within the Rapid City School District. And in fact, in plaintiff's complaint, it is indicated in the complaint, in their allegation, that the Rapid City School Board has the final determination of compensation that is to be paid. The Rapid City School District School Board is the entity that operates this system. If you look at the session law, you will see that the legislature was extremely clear that this is no longer to be a separate legal entity. By way of history that is available in the session laws, Western Dakota was originally set up between two school districts, the Meade School District and Rapid City, and proved not to be financially viable, as is indicated in the session law that was presented to the trial court. The legislature determined to change that and establish the Western Dakota Technical Institute under the Rapid City School District, said that it is totally subsumed within the Rapid City School District, and that it is not a separate legal entity.
If I look at one of the plaintiff's employment contracts, what does it say the name of the employer is?
My recollection is that I don't believe there is an employment contract in the record. If one was introduced, it would certainly control. I can tell you that it is approved by the Rapid City School Board, and the payment for these people comes from the Rapid City School District. The second issue that arises with respect to this matter of the service is important. There is an important distinction. This court for many, many years has required that there be personal service in the case of school districts, and has recently upheld that. In the very recent case of Bicek versus Bonhomme County, the court distinguished what was going on in Mazzeo. In Mazzeo, as you recall, the court said that substitute service upon a child of a school board member would be allowed, but nevertheless, personal service was still required. In the Bicek case, the court distinguished Mazzeo, and this court said that it was unwilling to follow Mazzeo line of cases with respect to what occurred in Bitech, and then made a specific holding that with respect to service of an appeal from the county commission, that service by mail is effective. No such holding had been made with respect to school boards, and none should be. The statute that allows service by mail is within 1565. And of importance there is 1565B. The last sentence, 1565B runs on at some length about how service is accomplished, you can do it on an attorney, et cetera, et cetera. And it gets around to saying that it can be done by mail and by facsimile. The last sentence says that the provisions of 1565 shall not apply to the service of summons or other process of any paper to bring a party into contempt. School districts are, whether blessed or cursed, I'm not certain, with the appeal provisions from SDCL Chapter 1346. this was cited numerous times in the brief, and a critical sentence in 1346 is found in 1346.4, and I'll confess to the court that I did not put this in my brief. The fact is that Ms. Duffy's argument required me to hit the books and think harder about what the distinction is. And if you look at 1346.4, it begins saying that upon such an appeal taken, this is an appeal that has been served on the board, the clerk of the committee or the business manager within 30 days will transmit to the clerk of courts a certified copy. here's the critical part of the sentence. Upon failure of such person to so transmit the record, the circuit court may compel the person to do so and may fine the person for neglect or refusal to transmit the record. Now, this language of the court having the power to compel the person to submit the record and to fine the person if they do not submit the record is certainly, if it does not use the specific word contempt, is certainly the exercise of the contempt powers of the court. When you look at the corresponding statute for counties, which would be found in 7-8-29, all it says is that once the appeal has been served and the bond has been filed, the clerk shall make out a complete transcript of the proceedings of the board relating to its decision and deliver the same to the clerk of courts. There's no provision for compulsion. There's no provision for fine. There's certainly business school districts.
That's kind of an around the corner kind of story here. More directly, are you aware of any situation in which something other than a summons, which is used to initiate an action in invoke jurisdiction, requires personal service? I mean, we use service by mail for notices of appeal in all different contexts because it is not the initial jurisdiction invoking document. And isn't that simply what's involved here? I mean, this is a notice of appeal. There's already a proceeding pending. Why would we have to require the personal service that's usually only reserved for summonses and complaints?
This goes into the mind of why the legislature may have made this difference. All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that they have said that the business manager of the school district is under a compulsion to do this, a compulsion which is enforceable by the court and can include a fine. Are there other in divorce proceedings, orders to show cause? There are documents that can bring a party into contempt that require personal service, which is exactly what it says in 1565. Next issue that the school district wants to bring to the attention of the court is the matter, the nature of this proceeding. What you have before you is the complaint. And in the complaint, the teachers indicated that they went to the school board and the superintendent, Dr. Wharton, and complained about the risk of pay. They were advised to talk to their union, the Western Dakota Teachers Collective Unit, which they did. A proposal was made. The proposal was not adopted. Negotiations under 318 are familiar to this court. That is exactly what occurred. Neither party called for an impasse. The proceedings that follow a collective bargaining process did not occur.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired.
Thank you. I'll ask one question.
Certainly.
Mr. Harmon, on this exhaustion under the 318, you're arguing that they need to invoke 318.
I'm sorry, I really...
You're arguing that they need to invoke 318 to exhaust. But I can find nothing in 318 that's mandatory. It appears to me that 318 gives each side a discretionary decision whether to bring in the Department of Labor. I can't see anything in 318 that mandatorily requires some kind of exhaustion before the Department of Labor.
What happens in the collective bargaining setting, Your Honor, is that when the public employer enters into collective bargaining with public employees, makes an offer which is not accepted, if neither side calls impasse, this becomes the contract between the parties. Their remedy for implementing the collective bargaining impasse is the impasse process. To allow teachers union, public employee unions to bypass the Department of Labor in collective bargaining and go directly through the 1346 appeal would essentially make the provisions of Chapter 318 a nullity. Appreciate the extra time as to the issues, we would rely upon our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Harmon. Ms. Duffy, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. The crux of the Equal Protection or the Equal Pay Act claim is this. There is no generic common law sex discrimination claim. All sex discrimination claims are premised on statute. You either file under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, or you can file if your discrimination takes the form of pay discrimination under the Equal Pay Act. If your claim is purely a state law claim, it's nevertheless based upon a specific South Dakota statute that prohibits sex discrimination in employment. The appellee's argument that, well, this is similar to Title VII, and if this were a Title VII claim, you could readily require them to administratively exhaust, that argument is specious. These are all statutory claims, and as such, the procedure that's allowable and permissible and required stems from the statutory language. There's no doubt that claimants under Title VII, whether it's race discrimination or sex discrimination, have to administratively exhaust. It's clearly required from the statutory language. Similarly, if you file a claim under South Dakota's sex discrimination statute, you have to administratively exhaust. It's required by the statute. The Equal Pay Act does not require administrative exhaustion. And because this is a statutory claim, this court is bound by the statutory guidelines that are set forth in that act. And merely because this case is pending in state court rather than federal court is of no moment whatsoever. This court was granted concurrent jurisdiction under the Equal Pay Act to handle these claims on an equal footing with federal courts. And both federal courts and state courts are bound by the same statutory language of the Act. Now, Justice Gilbertson, I think I may have misunderstood a question you asked me earlier when you asked whether the administrative agency would be competent to handle this claim. I understood you to be asking what would the Department of Labor be able to do with the notice of appeal issue.
No, I was asking if they had jurisdiction to grant relief if they had what you'd characterize as an illegal contract.
They do not. This case, were we to administratively exhaust, would go through the South Dakota Division of Human Rights, which has recently been moved from the Department of Commerce over to the Department of Labor. Under the authority granted to the Division of Human Rights, as you're aware, Title VII contains both equitable and legal remedies. You can obtain back pay, but you can also obtain the equitable remedy of reinstatement. Once you reach the conciliation stage of administrative exhaustion before the Division of Human Rights, they can broker an agreement that's based on the equitable remedies. They can get the employer to agree to reinstate the employee. They can get the employer to agree not to discriminate again in the future. But the Division of Human Rights has no authority to grant money damages. And that's what the Equal Pay Act is all about. Equal Pay Act is part and parcel of the Fair Labor Standards Act. It contains no equitable remedies. Reinstatement of a person's job is not one of the remedies that's available under the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's supposed to be a speedy and adequate way for employees to obtain the wages that they should have been paid in the first place. Whether that takes the form of a violation of the minimum wage or maximum hours provision or a violation of the Equal Pay Act. The Division of Human Rights, were we to administratively exhaust this case, would simply not have the jurisdiction or the authority to grant the relief that we're requesting, which is namely back pay.
So for that part of it, then you'd still have to go to court?
Yes. Yes, Equal Pay Act, you would still have to go to court if you're going to get the one and only remedy that's guaranteed under the Act. Again, the appellees attempt to distinguish the federal authorities in cases that we have cited to the court on the basis that this court is somehow licensed to disregard those authorities. That is not true. Nevertheless, we have cited the court, one state court case. It's the only case I could find, and that's the Colorado case, Lawrence versus State of Colorado, where the employee had an overtime claim, and the state attempted to impose an administrative exhaustion requirement for that claim. And the Colorado case said no. This arises under the Fair Labor Standards Act case. They cited to Ossofsky versus Wick, which is an Equal Pay Act claim that arose out of the DC Circuit, and said the state is not at liberty to impose additional procedural requirements here. To do so would violate the Supremacy Clause. So although it's only one case, it's one more than the appellees have been able to cite to you. Colorado certainly recognized that it is bound by the federal authority that's set forth both in the statute of the Equal Pay Act and in the federal cases that arise under that. And I would submit that this court is bound by the same authorities. On the equitable tolling argument, again, I would point out that the cases involving age and race discrimination that have allowed equitable tolling are fundamentally different from Equal Pay Act cases, and that's because both the age discrimination statutes and the race discrimination statutes require by statute that you administratively exhaust. Now, in South Dakota, we don't have a corollary to the federal age discrimination statute. So if a South Dakota employee wants to exhaust an age discrimination claim, he has to do so before the EEOC. But as to race discrimination claims, it's clear that South Dakota employees have to exhaust before the South Dakota Division of Human Rights. It's not unfair to require administrative exhaustion in those cases because it's required by statute. It is fundamentally unfair to impose a requirement on the Equal Pay Act at this late date. We would respectfully request that this court reverse and remand in its entirety and allow this case to proceed. Unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Duffy. This completes this oral argument. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.